Hey everyone, this is Josh from Solopreneur Grind, and I am here with Freddie Fry for what I think will be a very interesting episode. Freddie, really appreciate you taking the time to chat today.
Oh man, I'm excited to be here. Definitely appreciate you having me on as a guest.
My pleasure, and I am excited to hear more about your backstory. But for those who haven't heard about you, seen any of your stuff, can you tell us a little bit about who Freddie Fry is?
Definitely. Freddie Fry, basically I consider myself a life champion. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a speaker, voiceover talent, I'm a basketball coach. And also, funny fact is I'm an international underground hip-hop artist, a motivational lyricist and speaker. I wear a lot of hats. But basically what I try to do is I try to help people and empower people through my story and through my life transformation and give them tips, tricks, and tools to help them win the day, so ultimately they win at life. And thus my mantra is for us to make every day a wins day, W-I-N-S.
Right. And it was so clear when I took a look at your website that you have an awesome message. You definitely wear a lot of hats. It looks like you do them really well. And the hip hop motivation stuff really, really stuck with me because A, because I like hip hop, and B, because it's so unique. So I want to get into all that stuff. But first, usually where we like to focus is the beginning of your story. So like, what was Freddie Fry like even early on in high school? I read a little bit about your bio and you had a tough kind of upbringing.
Yes.
Or childhood. Could we start there and
sure.
Figure, you know, learn about the journey from the very beginning?
Well, the journey for me is, you know, I started, my mom passed away when I was 4 years old.
Wow.
My dad was strong enough to take me in. Of course, he, being a single father, didn't really know. It's ironic that he was a single father because later on in life, I became a single father. But he took me in and he worked a lot. And so he married a young lady who eventually became my stepmother, and she wasn't the best role model. I don't think she would have been like my real mother would have been. You know, unfortunately she was mentally abusive. She was an alcoholic, and she was a drug addict as well. And so that was a household that I grew up in. I grew up kind of quiet, shy, introverted, and got bullied when I was in elementary and I was in high school.
Right.
I got into music. I was always into sports. I was always into music. I would listen to MTV and anything MTV was playing. And then all of a sudden hip hop came out and I was introduced to Run DMC, and I just became this huge fan of Run DMC, and it just kind of motivated me to want to do hip hop. And so asked my dad, hey, can you give me some music equipment? I want to do music. But I was really shy and introverted, so I kind of wanted to just do music in my own space at home. I didn't really want to try to share anything with the world. And strange thing happened. Had a friend of mine, when we got to high school, he was like, there's a talent show, you know, that's going to happen, and I'd like for you to be in it with me. He said, I know you got the music equipment. I know you do music. I was like, you mean get in front of people? I was like, no, thank you. Not anything I want to do. And his name was Ernest Walker. And I always say I think everybody needs an Ernest Walker in their life, somebody to push them, that believes in them more than they believe in themselves. And this guy, and I kid you not, I mean, for the next 2 weeks, he persistently came over my house every day and asked me to be in this talent show. And I'm like, man, I'm not going to be in this talent show, so stop asking me. I don't know what it was. He wore me down. He came over and said, man, would you stop acting like a little old punk and just be in the talent show? And I was like, oh, my God, punk, I'll be in it. I'll do it. Before I knew it, I committed. And I was like, oh my God. And that, you know, I had to overcome the fear. I sat down and wrote my rap. And this was just a talent show, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was just a tryout. It wasn't even a talent show. So they called our name, and I went up there and said my rap. Call me Mr. Chiller, don't call me at all. When I'm on a mic, I'm standing tall. I'm 5'4" when I'm talking to you, but when I'm on the mic, I'm 7'2". You know, that was actual rap. I said too, it was so funny.
Wow. And,
but something in that moment changed. Everything in my life changed in that moment. It's like I felt like this burst of energy. I felt this confidence. I felt alive. And so I knew that everything in my life was going to be different, because I knew I'd found I struck gold. You know, I found hip hop, and hip hop was going to allow me to speak my piece to the world and get things off my chest and be transparent. And wow, everything changed. I mean, I became more popular because I was a rapper, and I was like one of the best ones in the school, and bullies stopped bullying me, and it just, everything just changed, you know? And I grew up in North Tulsa, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that's the hood, the ghetto. And I went to lowest performing schools, but I was a really smart, book smart kid. And so I did really well in school, but I never really was pushed. I didn't have to do any homework, anything. Mm-hmm. And got out and tried to go to college, but I wasn't really prepared for college because you really did need to study. And those are things I never did.
Right.
And met a young lady when I was in high school that became the mother of my children. And she lived in the projects. So I'd be over there all the time. And her brother knew that the guys that were part of my music group were selling drugs. And he wanted to sell drugs. He was in the projects. He was like, man, if you can just get it, I'll sell it for you. And I was scared. I had fear. I was like a scary kid. And so I was like, no, I'm not doing anything like that. Long story short, I wind up having a baby with his sister. And I think I was 20 and she was like 18 or something like that. And, you know, not ready at all. And right. I needed money. And so I had real easy access to get the crack. And so I would get it and I would give it to him. And unfortunately, he started smoking it. And so I started trying to sell it myself. And it was a big drug bust. And my kid's mother, she wound up putting the drugs on her. And it was just bad. And somehow, and I always look at my mom as my guardian angel, because throughout that process, my name never came up doing the drug thing. She wow. didn't, they wound up taking the drug charges off of her and putting it on the person whose drugs it really was. And of course I was out of the drug bill. I was like, I'll never do that again. But so I got through that phase of life. I was still doing music at the time mm-hmm. and wind up having four kids. If you can believe this, I had four Jeez. Kids by the time I was 25 years old. Same young lady. We weren't married. We were just out here just living, careless and reckless, you know. And so I wake up age 25 and I had an epiphany. And I just woke up and I like could see all the errors in my ways. I just realized how many mistakes I made. It was all clear. I believe it was like they call it your cerebral cortex. I think my cerebral cortex in my brain developed. And all of a sudden I had this reasoning all of a sudden. And the first thing I thought was, I need to get my children. I need to gain custody of my children. And it's so ironic because about that exact same time, I got a call from my kid's mom. They were living with her in the ghetto, in a bad area. And she called and said, could you possibly get the kids for a while? I'm kind of in a rough patch of my life and I'm struggling to be able to take care of them. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'll get them. I lived in a one bedroom apartment in a better area of town. All of a sudden I go from just me to having four kids living with me, three girls and a boy, ages 3 to 7.
Jeez.
Yes. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. I wasn't, you know, I was barely able to take care of myself. So I kept them for a few days. She calls me back and says, okay, I'm in a better place. Will you bring the kids back? I said, I'll bring them back under one condition. I said, if you have to call me again, I'm going to keep them. I'll go ahead and I'll raise them. You know, I don't mean you'll never be able to see them, but they're going to live with me. Because mm-hmm. I know you're in a tough place. I think I'm in a little bit better place than you are. And, you know, give you a chance to get yourself in order and keep them in a more positive environment. So she had them maybe about 3 or 4 weeks later. Her sister calls me and says, you know, you really need to get the kids. They're in a bad environment. They're seeing a lot of things they shouldn't see and things of that nature. And I was like, oh, okay.
Right.
And she calls. The mom calls.
Oh, wow.
She's like, can you get the kids again? I need you. I hit another rough patch. I was like, okay, I'll get them. And I get them. First thing I do is I go withdraw them from the school that they went. Now, I always laugh. Think back at this situation. I laugh. Here I am, a young black male going into a school, basically withdrawing kids blindly, you know, which would never happen in this day and age. Mm-hmm. They just gave them to me. They was like, okay, go ahead. You do what you need to do. And I told them where I was taking them. And they were all like, oh, that's a good school. You're doing good things. That's a great thing. And so we withdrew them. I got them enrolled in a school that was more by me. Week later, she calls me back. Hey, can you bring the kids back? I was like, they don't even go to the same school anymore. And I said, listen, we had this conversation before. Let me go ahead and take the kids. You go ahead and work your, get your life in order. And when the time comes, they'll be able to come visit on weekends and things of that nature. And reluctantly, she agreed. We never went to court. There was never any custody battles or anything like that. But it was the best decision for the kids, because a month or two later, the guy she was dating got murdered.
Wow.
In that neighborhood.
Four.
Yeah. And so, I'm raising four kids, three girls and a boy. I don't know how to do hair. I'm trying to do hair. I think I'm doing a great job learning how to do hair. And somehow, as when they got old enough to do hair, they wouldn't let me do the hair anymore. So I was like, okay, that's not been doing too great.
Right. But, Freddie, before we go on, can you tell a little bit more about what you were doing to support yourself, even from between high school to that age, 25? How was it you were able to take care of yourself, and how was it that you were able to move into, even if it was just a slightly better area, but a better area in general?
Yeah, that's a great question. I look back at that. Okay, so I was doing music. I was a hip hop artist, and so basically, I had created. It was small, but it was enough to make a little bit of a living. I was distributing my own music to different stores, and not only in the city, but in different states. So I had this small distribution network for my Player 1000 music, and I was generating enough to make a living. I also did little odd jobs. I never was a guy that would just work like a regular 9-to-5 job. I was always had an entrepreneurial mindset. So I would be the guy also that would create mix CDs with different various music on it. And I would go around to barbershops and beauty salons, and I would sell the CDs. So that was kind of how I was making ends meet. So, quote unquote, making ends meet at that time.
Right. Was that kind of always in your blood? Were you always entrepreneurial? Because it's very impressive to hear, especially considering the background, the fact that you were still able to, you did well in school. You found this creative outlet, this hip hop that you seem to use in a good way in so many different ways, right? Kept you out of trouble, kept you focused, kept you motivated, eventually started generating a revenue stream, which is awesome. Was that just kind of always your nature as well?
It definitely was. I was always the guy. I'm a thinker. And so if I was working a regular job, I would always just kind of do the math. Well, I'm making $8. Back then it probably was like $6, $7, and I'm working 8 hours. I'm making $48 an hour, $48 a day. And of course, taxes are going to come out. I was like, man, there's other things I could be doing to generate more money than that in a shorter period of time. And I just kind of always thought like that. Mm-hmm. And so when I was doing the music, I was one of the founding fathers of hip hop in Oklahoma, like one of the first ones to ever do it. First one to have a CD, the first one to have a tape, first one to be on the radio and things of that nature. So we always had this entrepreneurial mindset and this innovative mindset of doing things before someone else did it. And then I would figure out along the way how to make it work,
Right.
And that was a gift and that was a curse. I found that before, up to the point where I had my epiphany, but yeah, that was a mindset that I always had. And so it's crazy to think how I got to the point that I'm at today with the business that I run today.
Right. Yeah. And I'd love to go a little bit. I want to get back to the point where you left off before with your kids, because I definitely want to hear the end of the story. But could we go back to around the 18 to 20 year old age where you decided to start using hip hop as a, revenue stream? Like, how did you go out and make those first few sales? I guess more from the business side of things. Did you have any business? I don't remember getting much business training in high school. I'm wondering how you figured that part out.
I didn't have any business training, but I paid attention. See, okay, when hip hop, that was a moment in time when hip hop first started, which was when it became a little bit more known, was like 1979. About time when I started doing it was probably 87, 88, 89. Mm-hmm. It was what we call underground. It wasn't mainstream yet. Like groups like Run DMC, and there's a few of them that were mainstream, but the majority of hip hop was underground. And hip hop heads, as we like to call them, they were always searching for music that other people didn't have. It was always a badge of honor if you could be with your friends and you could play them music from an artist that they never heard of, a hip-hop artist.
Right.
I was a hip-hop head, so I understood that. And right. So when I started, when I made my very first tape, I didn't go to a pressing plant. I found a way to print my own, get blank cassettes that were clear, and mm-hmm. and go to a printing place and have them make me a stamp with my words and everything I wanted on it. And I would hand print the words on both sides of the cassette.
Right.
And I would package them. And so then I had this little company that would shrink wrap them. And so we had local stores. So it all started with the local stores, our little mom and pops. I would go to the mom and pop and I'd be like, okay, hey, we just released this product. We'd like to get it in your stores. And they were like, okay, well, if you give us a sample, if we can play it overhead, maybe people will buy it. And that's what happened. So when I went to my first local few stores, we had success. I had success selling my tapes. Mm-hmm. And so then I got to thinking, I was like, okay, well, if I can have success here. And I thought about myself as a consumer. And I knew I would go to the same record store that I was selling my music out of. And I would go back to the little, they'd have back in those days, and you may remember this, they'd have counters where you could listen to new music, mm-hmm. new releases. Yeah. And I would always go back to probably once a week, I would go to the store and I asked, what's new? And they would play. They would say, okay, well, this is new. And they'd let you test it. And if I like what I heard, I would normally buy it. And I'm thinking to myself, well, they have to be doing this in other cities. And so I started paying attention to the magazine. So like you'd have a magazine that would have these are the top 10 mom and pop stores in the region. I would research that. I would get the information. And then I would call those mom and pop stores and say, hey, I have a new cassette out or whatever. I think it was cassettes in, and we hadn't even got the CDs. It was just starting. Cassette mm-hmm. out. And I would love to either put it in your store on consignment. And some would be like, this is how I found this out. They were like, well, we don't really do consignment. What you can do is you can send us a promo. And if we like it, and if we can play it, what they would normally do is they get your promo in, and then they would test it with their consumers. Because it was in their benefit. I learned this real quick. It was in their best interest to try to do more business with independent artists like me and independent record labels, because they could make more profit. If I'm dealing with Warner Brothers or Sony, they're going to, it's more people, more hands in the pot. So they may wind up paying $7 or $8 at the end for a big name artist and only make $3 or $4 off of it. Well, they could get it from me for like $4 or $5 and make more profit. So if they can make my song or my album hot in their store, they can make more money. So what started happening is I started sending the tapes, and people in Omaha, Nebraska, Denver, Colorado, Seattle, Washington. I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Seattle, mm-hmm. Washington, Louisville, Kentucky. A lot of these different places, they like my music. Mm-hmm. And so they would play it. And then those stores would call me back and like, you know what? People really like your music. Can we buy 25 of your cassettes? They were buying them cash on delivery, COD. Mm-hmm. And so what deal could you give us now? And they'll tell us, well, most of the time we're paying $8 or $9 or $7 or whatever through a distributor. We don't want to pay that much. And I'd be like, well, it costs me less than $1 to print them. So I'll be like, okay, I'll sell them to you for $5 a piece. So I just started doing the math. It's like, if I can sell 25 here and 25 there and 25 there, you know what I mean? You generate some good income. And I probably had about 20 stores that bought my product. And so that's how I started. I would box them up and ship them up myself and send them out UPS, and it would just be checks coming back in the mail. And that's how that happened.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And mostly from, like you said, paying attention and just having the right mindset and thinking it through. So let's go back to your 25. You get full custody of the kids. What's the next step in the story?
Wow, and this is so funny because the story leads me to where I'm at today. So of course I'm raising the kids, and they get a little bit older. It's so wild. This story is so wild because at the time when I gained custody of my kids, I was dating a young lady that had 5 kids.
Jeez.
Yes. Yeah, that's the right response, because I look back and I say, Fred, what was you thinking? And then my response is always, oh, I wasn't thinking. which I wasn't.
At least you guys had something in common. Well, oh my probably God. Many more things, but that's definitely one thing, one big thing in common.
Oh, I remember taking nine kids. I'd have nine kids with me, and we'd be at Funhouse. You know, I'm like, what in the world am I doing? But the young lady I was with, she was broken. And so I came in trying to help her with her situation. And this, I was with her before I gained custody of my kids. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't even living together. We were dating. So I started coaching her son because I was I had a basketball background and I wanted to give back. Her son was a little bit older because she was a little bit older than me. Mm-hmm. And so I started coaching him in his school ball, basketball. And when I got my oldest daughter was seven. So fast forward a couple of years, my oldest daughter is nine. She had a 9-year-old. Her 9-year-old was tall because her father was a basketball player. He was about 6'8". Right. So she was tall. My daughter was short, but she was fast. And so when they got to third grade, they were both nine. I said, you know what? Let me start a team with these two. This is a good foundation to start a team. And so I started building a girls team. I stopped coaching the boys because I wanted to put my time into the girls. And this particular team got really good. Now, mind you, I was generating income, but it wasn't a lot of income because what happened was with hip hop, when it became mainstream, it kind of hurt the distribution business that I had going on because people went from not knowing what they wanted to hear. Because they wanted to hear it like and be the first on it, to now hip hop was on the radio and you had to hear it over and over again before you knew if you liked it. So it changed, everything changed. And so I still wasn't making a lot of income. But anyway, I started coaching this team and they got really good and we started traveling every year playing what they call AAU in big cities, really good team. This team became so good. By the time these girls graduated, I was able to get girls scholarships to Tennessee and UCLA and Baylor and big schools. They were really good. But throughout the process, we started playing in tournaments. And me and a guy, his daughter was on the team that I coached. We started just kind of paying attention. Again, paying attention. Right. It's like, well, we pay X amount of dollars to play in this tournament. There's 50 teams in the tournament. They all had to pay. And our parents pay to get in. That's concession. And we just started doing the math. It was like, this guy's generating a nice amount of income on a 2 or 3 day tournament, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we told ourselves that once our girls got a little bit older, we were going to start hosting tournaments. And so we created a company called Gym Time Hoops. Now, mind you, we were modeling off of the guy whose tournament we had been playing in. He was really the only one doing it. He would have a tournament once a month, sometimes twice a month. So when we went into the business, we were like, okay, we don't ever want to have tournaments on the same weekends that he would have them. Because normally you'd have them either Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or just Saturday and Sunday, always mm-hmm. two or three days. And so we were basically in our mind getting the second best dates available that people wanted to play. That was what we were thinking. And so we started doing the tournaments and we didn't have any contacts. We started in some really bad locations in the city. Really, oh God. I mean, it was one place we played. It was so bad. We couldn't even have tournaments there no more because a week after we had a tournament there, somebody actually got murdered at the gym site. So it was like, jeez. Oh my God. Yes. But, you know, I was always about shaking hands and kissing babies and customer service and the customer experience. And we started building relationships with people. We were able to get into better facilities. But I couldn't get over the hump. And I realized later on that it's because we were following somebody else's model. And me and my business partner, of course, we were splitting the profit. And it wasn't a lot of profit coming in. And so there were some internal issues and a few things happened. We really wasn't seeing eye to eye. And I didn't like splitting because I was broke. And right. I was 3 months behind on my rent. And so I told my business partner that, you know, I have to do this myself. I can't split anymore. I can't be in a partnership anymore. I said, you can have all the naming rights. You can have everything. I'm going to do it different. And, you know, he was like, no, you don't want to be out there by yourself. I promise you, you can't do this by yourself. You know, started pointing at doubt and trying to make me fear. And I just told myself, you know what? I'm going to use that doubt. I'm going to use that as fuel. And the first thing I did when I left him, I knew I was going to continue to do tournaments. I just knew I was going to do it different. I was going to create this blank canvas, and I was going to sit down and really think it through before I started back. And so I sat down and I said, what problem can I solve in the world of youth basketball? And I thought about me being a coach, and I thought about listening to parents as I coach them and playing in tournaments. And the first thing that hit me was people would rather not play a lot on Sunday because of church and family. And we always played on Saturday and Sunday. You know, I always played on Sunday. And I was like, okay, maybe I can try to host Saturday only event. Would that be feasible? How would that work? No one had been doing it. Mm-hmm. That was the first thought process. Then the second thought process was, when do we play? I said, I'm 3 months behind on my rent right now, trying to do it like somebody else, trying to guess when teams want to play, trying to guess when teams are available or more teams are available. I said, well, how about I just have a one-day tournament every Saturday and just, in a sense, make it like a job, make the business like a job, have it every Saturday and let teams come in and play three games, or let them play two, really, really lock in on customer service, really lock in on being customer friendly and being able to let teams play in the time frame that they want to play, schedule request friendly. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, that was the best decision I ever made in my life. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it for 10 years now, 10 years straight, and it's just grown. But within three months, everything was different in my life.
Right, just from that one business venture?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Just from that one, those just sitting down and mapping out a course and really thinking it through and figuring out what problem you can solve and not just totally taking somebody else's model as law, being bold enough to step out on faith and bet on yourself. And I bet on myself and I hit on my bet. And sometimes you have to say, you know what? I like his model, but that model works for him. Everybody's model that works for them is not necessarily going to work the exact same way for you. And we were losing because we were trying to use his model for us, and it wasn't designed to work that way. And I realized that when I went by myself, I need to create my own model. He had already did that, and it just changed everything for me.
Right. That's amazing. And the question that you sat down and thought about, which is, you know, what is the problem here and how can I provide value? Those are both such important. I mean, those pretty much summarize business courses, right?
Yes.
In a way, they're so key.
They are.
So that's amazing. So this business kind of takes off. And what stems from that success? Because as I know, you know, that's definitely not the end of your career, especially if you just take a quick look at your bio. What else came from that?
Well, what came from that is I bought my time back. You know, the first thing I did was I started that. Let's see, when I started doing, when we started doing tournaments, it was like 97. And so I had stopped doing music. When I gained custody of my kids, I stopped doing music. Because when I was doing music before, the majority of my songs always had a purpose, always had a meaning, but they did have profanity. They were a lot more street-oriented. And so one thing I died to was the street-oriented aspect of my music when I gained custody of my kids, because I had to lock in and really try to be the best father that I could for them, and it just took a lot of time. And so for the next, let me see. Like I said, my oldest was 7. By the time she got 16, two things happened. One was they got older. Of course, they started to liken hip hop. Mm-hmm. But I got a call from a guy, and he was like, there's this guy in Texas that's wanting to get in touch with you. He wants to buy some of your old music. And I said, okay, give me his number. So I call him up, and he's like, I have basically an underground online hip hop store. And he said, we sell music to people all across the world, basically out of print hip hop. And I always send out a list. I send out a questionnaire asking people what artists would they like to have music from. And he said, just about every list had your name on it, Player 1000. And what I didn't know is, you know, I told you that I started a small distribution with my company, but we also in the process got a national independent distribution deal. I had no idea they were selling our stuff overseas with that, right. But they were. And so he asked me when I gained custody of my kids, we had just released an album called For the Meal Ticket, but we never promoted it. So it was out there, but it never really was out there. And he asked me if I had any copies of that. And I was like, yeah, I had a box of them, you know, several boxes in my garage. He said, well, I'd like to buy some off of you. Now, mind you, this was, that probably came out, this was like 8-9 years after the release of the project.
Right.
And typically when you sold projects, like I told you before, to stores, you'd get $5, $6, $7 a piece. Well, he was like, I want to buy 20 of them off of you for $20 each. No. I'm like, whoa. Okay. And I was pretty broke. So I was like, I had these kids. I was like, send the money. I'll send you the CDs, you know. So he sent me the money. I sent him the CDs. Week later, calls me back. Wants to do it again. I'm like, okay. He sent me the money. I sent him the CDs. Week later, calls me back again. This time, this is what's so crazy. He's like, you've never, I need to buy 20 more, but you've never asked me what I'm doing with your CDs. I said, well, I really didn't want to know because it just seems so weird what you're doing. I couldn't imagine anything illegal, but, you know. He said, are you by a computer? I said, yeah. He said, okay, get on there and go to eBay. Went to eBay. He said, type in Player 1000. So type in Player 1000. He was auctioning my CDs. And people were paying. People were paying. They would auction. An auction would end. They would pay about $500 for one CD.
Jeez.
Can't make it up. And this is what's so crazy about eBay. And if any of your listeners know about eBay, they know that if you do an auction, it may not even be the same now. That was, you know, I don't know if it is or not. But then if you, people, all the people that bid on it, you could give them second chance offers if they didn't win the bid. And so somebody might have bid $500, they won. Somebody might have bid $499, they lost. $498 lost. $497 lost. $495, $490.
Right.
He could go back and sell them CDs at those prices to those
people. Oh my God.
He was making upwards of $8,000 to $10,000 on every 20 CDs he was buying.
Jeez. And he told you that.
He told me, he said, you seem like a good guy. And he said, I want to do more business with you because I have contacts in Japan and I have a contacts in Germany and they are willing to pay obscene amounts of money for anything that you produced that you haven't released. And so we started doing business together and it was at such a great time for me when that happened, but it sparked me back into music with the thought process that my kids were hearing music and I never let them hear any of my music because it had profanity. Mm-hmm. And so I got with my friend Durrell, which is my best friend, and basically he makes the music, I write the songs, and I said, man, you know, we just stopped doing music, and we never said we were going to stop doing music, we just did, and life just moved on 7-8 years later. I said, let's go clean up some of these songs that we have that have great messages, but they have profanity in it. I said, I want to take my kids, I want my kids to go through the process with me of producing an album. And he said, cool. And so we found a studio that could take the music off the reel to reel, and we went in and we cleaned them up, and during the process we got the itch to create new music. Mm-hmm. Now I knew that when I created new music it wouldn't have any profanity, it was going to all be positive and uplifting, and I never was a motivational speaker or anything like that, but I was writing a song and one of the lyrics said, I'm trying to get you to see right like an optometrist. And I stopped when I wrote the line. I was like, 2020 vision. And I said, okay, that's going to be the new mantra. That's going to be the title of this album, because the goal was the younger you can get kids to see life clear, the more success they will have.
Right.
2020 vision. The quicker You know, because with us, we don't see life clear. But I've lived long enough now to where I see life clear. So it was twofold, trying to get people to see life clearer and realizing that now hindsight is 20/20. And so from there, we made this album. My kids got to go through the process. And it started my journey of motivational hip-hop, of motivational speaking. And then I came across, have you ever heard of Eric Thomas?
No, I don't think I have.
Eric Thomas is one of the top motivational speakers in the world. He does he used to do a series every Monday called Thank God It's Monday. Put a video out every day, every Monday on YouTube. And so I started kind of modeling off of him and doing some videos. And it led me to everything that I'm doing now, the motivational speaking, the motivational voiceovers with these companies that are getting millions of views, and me going out and speaking, you know, in a lot of different places all across the country. And it all came from basically a guy selling my CDs on eBay for thousands of dollars.
Right.
And unreal. Right. You can't make it up. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah. And that's why, and I've been talking about this a little bit recently in some of my content, the reason why I think almost everyone should be putting out content today, whether it's hip hop music, YouTube videos, Instagram photos, is because you never know what can come from it, right? When you were making those CDs or cassette tapes or whatever they were at the time, I mean, that was like a decade before all this even came to fruition. So you don't even know what may or may not come from it down the road. But in most cases, if you're putting out good stuff with a good message, there probably isn't going to be much bad that could happen, right?
True. Very
probably
true.
More likely that something good or even a good connection or a good relationship gets established from it.
And it all came from there. You know, I started doing I transferred it from just the rapping to the speaking. And now I use the hip hop as motivation and they work hand in hand, spoken word and storytelling. And just when I started releasing the videos, I had someone reach out to me. I thought it was the craziest thing. I started putting them on YouTube. And it's a company called Fearless Motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And Fearless Motivation, I mean, they have over almost 2 million subscribers on YouTube. They have all their videos get well over a million views. Well, the guy said, you know, I came across this video, and I was wondering if you could create some speeches for our channel like this. And he sent me a link. And I click on a link and it was me, you know, I'm like, what the heck? You know, I said, well, yeah, I sure can. And, you know, and I still work with them to this day. And I mean, I'm on a video voiceover with them for it's called Say Thank You. And it's me and Denzel Washington. And it has well over 70 million.
That's good company.
Yes, it is. And so I just parlayed it, and I work with a lot of different other voiceover companies now too, and I'm probably the voice of videos at 150, 200 million views.
Wow. I'm going to have to look that up, because the first thing I do when I wake up as part of my morning is I'll do some stretching. And usually what I do while I'm doing the stretching portion of my routine is I'll put on a motivational video from YouTube. So I'm going to have to get you to send me some of those links.
Oh, for sure.
So I can get those playing and we can link to them in the podcast description.
Definitely. Oh, let's please do that. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I post on my page, you know, my video page as well, for sure. Just let me know what you need to do. But no, it all came from that. It's just, you know, you pay attention, you put good out into the world, and the universe is going to bring good back to you.
For sure. And then, Freddie, how did you continue that growth and balance it all, right? Because you have the basketball tournament going successfully now. You have all of these opportunities coming for motivational speaking, this hip-hop music that you've kind of taken a slightly new angle with. And all this time, you're still a father, right? So how are you balancing this workload? Do you work long hours? You know, what's your kind of approach to work in general?
Well, now, you know, the good news is I have a good team. As far as my court time events, I have a good team in place. Now, I still do, you know, most of the scheduling and things of that nature, but I do have a routine. So I know each week when I should be doing what I should be doing. And so I just kind of, I schedule it out. My kids are a little bit older now. So, so that's, you know, the good news is they're out the house. So they're out doing their thing. And it all of it started when they got a little bit older anyway. You know, they were basically almost out when I finally started having the next level of success, I would say. And so it is a juggling act, because even to this day, I'm still trying to figure out how to balance all of this. The bread and butter is court time events, is a tournament. So that always takes precedent over everything. Mm-hmm. So that's laid out, and it's working pretty good. I try not to get complacent with it, because, you know, everything changes. And so I'm continuing to try to keep that grow that. But I put everything else, like, I know what day I'm going to go record videos. I know when I'm going to edit. I know when I'm going to write and different things like that. So it is definitely being structured and being organized and being committed and being dedicated to doing the things that are, I say, like, I have my business side. And the blessing in that is that I'm able to add value, because I'm able to help a lot of underprivileged kids play that couldn't afford to play in other circumstances. So I'm able to still add value and generate income. But then everything else is adding value. It's not necessarily bringing a whole bunch of more income into me. It's just pouring into the world and allowing the world to pour back into you at a later time.
Right. That's really great. And what would you say to someone who is working a 9-to-5 right now, maybe feeling a little bit lost? They kind of love the story and the, I mean, what really stands out to me here, Freddie, is that you were just kind of following passions and working really hard and asking yourself the right questions and thinking about them in the right way. What would you tell to someone who wants to start a path like that of their own, but they're kind of lost in university, or they're working a corporate job they don't enjoy? What would you tell them?
I would definitely tell them to, if you have a passion, you have a desire, and you feel like there's a way to, I always try to say, don't be money driven, but I can't speak on somebody else's situation. If you have a family, if you have a wife, if you have children, you have to make sure those responsibilities are taken care of. So say if you're in that situation, then you have to really ask yourself the questions like, what problem can I solve? And then figure out how can you start it and make it make sense in your life, where you don't disrupt everything. You don't disrupt everything in your life. You do have to disrupt and get uncomfortable with what you're doing yourself, mm-hmm. but you have to create a plan that you can start taking those baby steps to put yourself in a position to where you can leave your job or you can leave your situation. But I would never advise anybody, if they needed income, to just leave their job. I say just start pursuing your passion, make it work within your lifestyle, step out of your comfort zone, because it's going to require you to spend, you're going to have to probably find an extra 2 or 3 hours every day to dedicate to whatever your passion is. But ask yourself questions, tough questions, figure out where can you stand out, where can you be different, what problem can you solve, and pay attention to what the universe is telling you. Pay attention to the signs that, because you may already be operating in it. Like me, I was coaching my daughters and I didn't even realize that's what my business was going to be later on in life. You may already be operating in your gift, and you just got to find a way to parlay it into the next, take it to the next level. Like, I just paid attention to the other person that was throwing the tournaments. I said, well, he's doing it, I can do it. And I modeled him first, and then I figured out a way to make it my own. That's the same thing. If you're in corporate America and you're working a job that you could, that you're in a business that you could do and parlay and make it your own business, figure out learn the ins and outs, learn everything you need to learn, and then find a way to solve a problem and find a way to make it your own. And what is going to figure out what separates you from anybody else that's doing the same thing. Because there's really nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. All you can do is give it your own wrinkle. And when people think of you, they think, man, he's doing, when I think of this person, I think customer service. I think this, I think that, whatever it is, to make yourself stand out from the crowd. That's kind of what I was saying there.
Right. That's really awesome advice. Freddie, this has been great. One last question for you. As you've been going through this amazing story and journey of your own, have there been any resources that you have really relied on, any books or authors or podcasts or anything like that, that have, or people that have really helped you along the way?
Yeah, honestly, two people stand out to me. I've always been a a person that sought out motivation. I think I was always on this quest to have an organized life and really try to make sense. I was different. I grew up in the hood, and I was different than the majority of the people that I grew up around, and they knew it. But Zig Ziglar, I always listened to Zig Ziglar. I always listened to Tony Robbins, and I really dug into people like that. And a lot of the teachings really stuck with me. And so I just, again, I take what I learned from those guys, and I make it my own.
Right.
It's integrity. It's composure. It's a strong work ethic. It's belief, even when nobody else is believing in you, it's belief, even when you're not seeing the plant grow, but knowing that if you keep watering it and keep giving it the right sunlight, it's coming. And so, yeah, I think those two were very instrumental in keeping me pushing the right direction.
Awesome. That's great stuff. Freddie, really appreciate you coming on and sharing this awesome story with us. Where can people find out more about you or learn more about you if they're interested?
Oh, yeah, they can. You can always visit our website, freddiefry.com. Everything on social media, if you just search Freddie Fry Motivation, FreddyFry, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, just search Freddie Fry, you'll find us. You can subscribe, hit the bell on YouTube. Daily, we're releasing memes, we're releasing videos, releasing information to help you be the best version of yourself. And like I said, ultimately, we're trying to help people overcome anything they're going through. Because I know sometimes people feel stuck and they feel like, oh, I'm getting older, or it could never happen for me. Yes, it can happen for you. If you pay attention to the signs, believe in yourself, let your passion become your purpose, and keep fighting and never quit. And if you win 1 minute, you can win 1 hour. If you win 1 day, you can win 1 week and win 1 month. Before you know it, you're making every day of your life a Wednesday. And that's what the mantra is.
Awesome. That might have been the best plug of a website I've ever heard with that added motivation at the end. Freddie, thanks so much again for coming on and sharing your story. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, man.
Hey, everyone. Josh here, checking in just one last time. Wanted to say thanks so much for listening to the podcast episode. I hope you got a ton of value out of it. And if you want to keep getting more of the Solopreneur Grind content, make sure to join the email list. What I do is send 3 emails a week with additional content such as what's going on in the background of my solopreneur journey, insights I'm having on business, and updates when new podcast episodes like these come out as well. It's free. It always will be. The link to join is in the description of whatever podcast platform you're listening this to on. Really hope to have you on the list and continuing to share these awesome solopreneur journeys and insights with you as well. Have a great day and hope to see you soon.